Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Ricky Lee Jones about her memoir, Last Chance Texaco, Chronicles of an American Troubadour. We'll also hear from Pia Z. Earhart about her new book, Now We Are 60, created with her sister, artist Nina Temple. Sometimes you sit down with a book and you get to live another life. That's what happened to me with Ricky Lee Jones' fabulous new memoir, Last Chance Texaco, Chronicles of an American Troubadour. Ricky Lee Jones has lived a big life, on stage and off, and has two Grammys, lots of stories to prove it, and now this full-fledged memoir. She lives in New Orleans now, and we are lucky to have her here as part of our musical and literary community. Ricky Lee Jones, welcome to The Reading Life.
I'm so glad to be here at last.
Me too. Now, one of the things I love about this book is that in the story of one family and your life in this often very fractured family, you paint a portrait of so much of American life. Your family has roots and mythology that go all the way back to vaudeville and the Great Depression. So talk about what it was like to going back to the very beginning of your family.
Well, first, let me thank you for what you just said, because that was how I felt about it. But that you got that from the writing, that feels great. It's an American life. And within the larger framework of it sounding like a big mishmash of chaos and trouble, there is an attempt at structure and close family. I'm always telling these stories to myself. So initially, that wasn't a big leap. I wrote about my father's stories in the war for my 1984 tour for the magazine, which was a kind of a performance piece more than music.
Right.
And my mother's stories have been stories I've shared with friends over the years. But to begin to compile the short stories for a larger piece and understand that you can't just tell the stories for the sake of the stories. There has to be a larger arc that, in my case, is always revealed to me. I don't usually set out with a particular message I'm going to say. I find out at the end what it was.
Well, so much of these stories are sad stories. I mean, your mother grew up in an orphanage. Your father came back from the war with PTSD. And you were a family often on the move looking for work and better opportunities. And you saw a lot of America, but not always the American dream.
And so the American dream back then just seemed to be a superficial image. I don't think they told anybody what they were supposed to find inside of the dream. And it was a country in so much change, you know, from whatever the world was up until the beginning of the 20th century. Once those two wars happened, it was a different world. And I think that all the people everywhere, humanity, was trying to figure out who they were, including those in pursuit of the American dream. So they had those nice crew-cut haircuts and gloves and hats, but behind it were a bunch of alcoholic veterans and women who had two archetypes they could follow, the blonde, you know, bombshell, or the nice mother at home, and all those things. So the American dream eluded my family forever. But they did do one thing for me, which was pass on, I think, the dignity of my grandfather on vaudeville, because he was success. He was an artist, And that was, in our family, the highest thing you could achieve. That's a great gift.
The other thing, against the background of all this, the story of your musical life, is you see the changes in women's lives unfolding across our lifetimes, because I'm just a little older than you are. And so I remember so many of the same things. And I love it when you saw the Beatles and you said you didn't want to be a Beatles girlfriend. You wanted to be the Beatle.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, you never saw yourself as the girl in your musical imagination. Where did that confidence and ambition come from at the very beginning?
I wonder. I could give you little pieces, but I don't know if that's where it comes from. You know, my mother always said she was a tomboy. But what that meant was she wasn't going to be the second fiddle. She wasn't going to be the little lady who made the cocktail with that poor dad when dad got home from work, you know. And somewhere in there was the understanding that if you identify yourself as male, you can do anything. But if you accept the one role offered to the girls, that's all you'll do. And nobody said it. I just got it. So I think I understood without saying it out loud that in order to go where I was going to go, I had to be the boy.
You're claiming all of your experience, the good and the bad. And one of the things I love is that you claim your place in the musical world when you talk about the women who came after you would have a much wider palette from which to draw their colors, you know?
Yes.
And that is a really important thing for people to know.
So often other people write our history, and they're people without the knowledge of the subtleties or the reality of having been there, people 20 or 30 years younger who see it from afar. And that's a valid view, but it's not the only view. So I thought, you know, and I was raised Catholic, and or just like so many of us, to be modest. But I see so many people saying, this is what I did, and I did this, and I do heaven and hell. So I thought, maybe it's okay to say, this is what I did, and not feel like I'm ringing my own bell, or feel okay about ringing my own bell. I know these sound, I live right next to the railroad track, sorry. I know these sound like dubious answers, but, you know, these are emotional topics, and I think that's why they're written well, because I had to really deal with them.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ricky Lee Jones, whose new memoir is Last Chance Texaco, Chronicles of an American Troubadour. There's a lot of spiritual autobiography in this book that appeals, that's going to appeal to a lot of readers, because you seem to be coming to a kind of reckoning with time itself and with age. And you say of your performances, my secret courage is my magic. So has that always been part of your performance, or is that something you're strengthening as you're getting older?
I think, yes, strengthening as I get older, at least understanding as I get older. Sometimes I feel like I was at the end of a whip, whipping me around my own nature. I think that the Coen brothers wrote it in something, but now when I perform, I rarely have any sense of my ego or myself being on the line. I more have a sense of the audience's needs being on the line. And it's a total reversal from the way I experienced my performance when I was a kid. And because I feel this wonderful obligation to them and joy with them and understand they came to be loved by me, and not go, I hope they love me. What do I got to do to get them to love me? They already love you. They came.
Right.
They paid money to be there. So just give them love back. That's all you got to do. Try to sing the best you can and fill your heart with love. And that is the thing that took a lifetime just about to learn and makes it joyful to perform. Yeah.
And you've said now your determination is to be a joyful noise.
That's right.
Which I love. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, you talk about this in your acknowledgments when you say you're grateful for patience, which is rather than a virtue, a muscle, and you can grow a big one if you have the time to wait. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I guess if we think of it, patience as a virtue, it seems like something out of our control. We're either good or we're not good. But I learned patience from the years of taking care of my mother, from the years of raising my daughter, from all the things that were challenges to me that I overcame or turned and looked back to back at myself and said, good job. Look, you're so much better at that now than you would have been.
Talk a little bit about being older, because you've come up against that invisibility that older women often feel, and you've talked about that lately.
It's better this age. When you first start to get a little older in show business, say at the age of 45 or 40, when the other girls and boys are still measuring you as a sexual being, but you're not as acute at it, you're not 25, so, you know, they're kind of nudging you out of the way. That's the hardest place. Once they decide you're an older lady, they treat you with respect again. You can get away with stuff you can never get away with at 40. You can do all the things that grand old ladies can do, and you should do it. Wear that purple. Come on out there and say what you have to say. So I find that I, you know, inside, of course, I feel exactly the same.
So how have you found New Orleans as a place to work? I mean, if you just read this book, and if you listen to The Other Side of Desire, this seems like it's been an incredibly productive time for you in the past years.
It really has. It's nice that you point this out, because I was just thinking yesterday, I've been here 8 years, and I was trying to remember if there was anywhere I lived for 8 years before, because even in L.A., I moved 30 miles over there, 50 miles over there. That would be a long ways here. Although I did take a break for a year while I was working on the book. So it's just invigorating to me. I hate, you know, sometimes I don't say happy stuff out loud because I'm afraid something will attack it. But I feel connected to my youth. I feel connected to the world around me, which I never had in L.A. I love how friendly the people are here. And almost every time I walk out of my house, somebody walks up and starts talking to me. That would never happen anywhere else. And that's good for me. It's really good. Because if you read the book, you'll see that nobody came up and talked to me when I was little. So I get a lot of joy just walking out my door here.
Well, how do you feel when you look at this book now? I mean, how is it moved you along in your life? Was writing it the process you hoped it would be? Is, you know, people are going to go off and sit down with your life in an easy chair and devote hours to it and think about it. So what would you tell them?
Here's what I thought as I wrote it. I went, this is the story of one woman's life in this time and place. I started it back, I think, in the other century. in the 21st century, here's what life was like. The fact that I was famous is secondary, helps me tell my story. But many women have had, you know, many of the things that happened to me happened to them. My generation, we're burying our parents. Here's what it feels like. We've raised children. Here's what that was like. But my story was incredible. It was a little different. It was a little redder and bluer and blacker and whiter. It was stronger than folks who didn't grow. You know, I don't want to say better. I just want to say bigger and deeper. And so reads like Huckleberry Finn or Charles Dickens or a wonderful cinematic movie, because that's the truth of it. But I thought in 100 or 200 years, I want somebody to be able to pick up this book and go, so that's what it was like.
Yeah.
That would be incredible. And I think if you read it for the summer, it'll be kind of like reading Last Day Huckleberry Finn, except it's a girl on a road.
Now, I'm curious. You leave the door open a little bit for a sequel. Is that a possibility? You think you can tackle another book?
Oh, yeah. I'm already writing in a different way, not continuing the voice of this one. But I think I have a really good idea of a way to keep telling stories. Yeah, I think it's kind of delightful. And I've been working on it already.
Yes. Yes, well, that's the best answer of all.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Ricky Lee Jones, whose new book is Last Chance Texaco, Chronicles of an American Troubadour. Ricky Lee, thank you so much for your music and for this remarkable book, and so glad you're in New Orleans.
Thank you for your very thoughtful questions. I'll be soaring on them for the rest of the day. I'm not kidding.
I know where I'm going, because I've been there before, floating in the sun, and laying on the shore, I caught a beautiful wave, I came in all the way, please help me climb.
Pia Earhart is one of New Orleans' best-known writers of short stories and personal essays. She's the author of Famous Fathers and Other Stories, and today we're talking about her new book, Now We Are 60. It's a collaborative book with her words paired with her sister, Nina Temple's, gorgeous art. Pia, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
What a gorgeous book this is. So tell us about the decision to collaborate with Nina.
Well, I had decided last year that I was going to write a flash a day. This was in January before COVID. So I had accumulated dozens and dozens of these short pieces that were, a lot of them based on memoir.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, wouldn't it be neat? I knew that I had the heading, Now We Are 60, because that's, I was writing, I'm writing about aging, and I'm writing about aging and longer marriages, and having a mom with Alzheimer's and just things that happen as we get older. And I thought, boy, I sure would love to have art along with this book. And so I was thinking about artists, and then Nina has an Instagram account, and her work just popped into my view one day, and I just thought, oh my God, there's my answer.
Right in front of your nose.
Right in front of my nose. And so I asked her if she would collaborate with me, and she said, sure, because she doesn't often turn me down.
No,
rarely. And she's like, sure. And then we just set off on this book. And I mean, her pieces were all pretty much all existing. She'd already done them. She'd titled them. But there was just like this kind of sixth sense in terms of the things that we think about and kind of our feeling about our family and kind of the aptness of her work with mine. So it really just became a matter of, okay, look, I'm going to put my piece on the left and I'm going to put your piece, you know, one of your pieces on the right. And then sometimes you're going to be, the biggest argument we had really was her being on the right, the right-hand page, because she always wanted to be on the left. I said, no, sometimes you're going to be the first thing the reader sees, you know?
Well, so, that was very nice of you, I think.
Yeah, we just went back and forth like that. Yeah, and it took the year to do it. Just lots of new writing and, you know, futzing.
Well, that going back and forth between the two of you is something that's got a long history. So read us the preface to set us up.
Sure. Move closer. For 15 years, it was only my first sister and me. Our parents moved often, flying across the ocean, driving us cross country. So Nina and I were the perpetual new girls, missing what and whom we'd left behind. But we always had each other, and in every house, we slept in twin beds. Nina couldn't sleep unless I answered her when she told me goodnight. Goodnight, she'd say. Goodnight, I'd say. But there'd be one more thing, one more thought, about a clueless boyfriend, a hard teacher, a mean girl, what outfit to wear tomorrow. With each other, we felt as secure and successful as billionaires. Okay, good night, she'd say. Good night, I'd say. Should I get a pixie cut, she'd ask. It'll grow out, I'd say. Okay, good night, she'd say. If I paused to mess with her, she'd plead, Pia, say good night. Good night, Nina. And then silence for a bit, and then, Nina, can I borrow your white poet's blouse? It was the 70s, bell-bottom, platform, love's baby soft, fruity Bonnie Bell lip gloss whistles on cords around our necks. Maybe, if you don't sweat. Now hush, I'd say, sleepy. This is the last good night. Finally, I'd hear her breathing rasp, then so could mine. This book is me and my sister back in twin beds, a writer and an artist, me on the right, my sister on the left, or vice versa, in our 60s, with aging parents and grown kids and grandchildren, living on opposite sides of the country, but sharing a room again with things to say before we sleep.
I love that. You know, I remember Love's Baby Soft and the fruity Bonnie Bell lip gloss.
Oh, yeah. I bet if you go to Walgreens, you can still find that Baby Soft.
I think so.
Or Amazon.
So what was it like for Nina to read these pieces? Because they're short, but they pack such an emotional punch. Because you're talking about, so much of this is about memory and forgetting and your mother's dementia, and just that kind of huge passage.
Honestly, I was worried that it would be a problem that I would be speaking for her also when I really normally am speaking for myself. But I think she fell deep into the work. I think she fell in love with the work. She never fact-checked me on anything or said, you know, that's not how I remember it happened. Or she loves anything that has to do with products and all the great cultural stuff that we went through together. And then the music is something that we grew up in a musical family, and that's something that we share, being the two oldest sisters out of four. And so I don't know, Susan, she was very, very tender and very supportive about all of it. We've had our thorny years. This was a smooth, like wide open territory that we crossed together. That was just a joy.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, yeah. Describe her art. It's so arresting, and I don't know, I really enjoyed looking at it.
She worked in an improvisational way. She works on this paper that's very absorbent, mm-hmm. and she uses different kinds of ink from different countries, different colors, different viscosities. It's improvisational, it's intuitive. There's a chemical thing that happens when there's water on the paper and then she adds ink, or vice versa, when there's ink on the paper and she adds water, which is like that wonderful marbling that you see in the pieces.
Yes.
Staining. I find them absolutely mesmerizing.
But her color palette is so distinctive.
Yeah.
You talked so much about all of your life in this book. Do you ever now sit back, now that you're a little older, and go, wow, you know, I've really done a lot?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my parents are not easy to have as parents, but what they gave us in terms of music, oh my God, the music is just immense. The arts, the fun of travel, a kind of sophistication and openness,
mm-hmm.
a lot of different kinds of experience. It is a lot. It is a lot. There's a lot more to write about. But yeah, I mean, I'm grateful. I loved being their kid when I was young. I loved it. Got a little bit tougher when Nina and I were adolescents, and you know, that tougher, even tougher as the years went on. But God, it was wonderful. It was just so much fun when we were young. We just were their tag-alongs.
Well, it's so funny, because to read this book is to appreciate so many things in that kind of wonderful detail that you pick up on, just the sound of wearing corduroy, for example,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or the taste of something especially wonderful. I mean, it's
mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
pure pleasure, Pia, all the way through.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad that you like it.
I do. We've been talking with Pia Earhart. The new book is Now We Are 60, Words by Pia Z. Earhart, Inks by Nina Z. Temple. You'll love it even if you're only 40 or if you're 70. Pia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It was great to talk to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Kelly Harris DeBerry will be the guest at Virtual Happy Hour, Friday, April 16th at 5, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Addie Tebbe signs Sir Bone Funk, Living Life in the Key of Triumph. at a socially distant event Saturday, April 17th from 2 to 3:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Jason Berry signs City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300 at a socially distant event Sunday, April 18th from 1 to 2:30 at Blue Cypress Books. The New Orleans Writers Workshop has three upcoming classes. Allison Alsop teaches writing the very, very short story beginning April 19th. Jessica Kinnison teaches The Mystery of Suffering, How to Write What Hurts, starting April 28th, and Brad Richard teaches How to Write a Poem, beginning May 1st. Go to neworleanswriters.com to register. Denny S. Bryce discusses her book Wild Women in the Blues in a Zoom conversation with Farah Roshan, Tuesday, April 20th at 6. Free, but a ticket is required. For info, gardendistrictbookshop.com. The New Orleans Poetry Festival continues throughout the month of April. Check out nolapoetry.com for the complete schedule. There will be a tribute reading to poet Lee Grues Sunday, April 18th at 5 with poets Gina Ferrara, Peter Cooley, Julie Kane, and Valentine Pierce. Join on Zoom or watch on Facebook. Check out nolapoetry.com for details. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.